Blog Talk Radio.
Drinking coffee.
Have you ever wondered about your mental health? Are you asking, how do some people seem so happy all the time? Do you wish you knew how to enjoy life more? Would you like to find out what a joyologist does? Are you ready to try something new and exciting? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions, I would like to welcome you to BigMediaUSA.com. I'm January Jones, the wine tester, inviting you to enjoy my show today with the topic, Thou Shalt Not Wine, featuring the laughter cure for my soon-to-be-published book, Thou Shalt Not Wine, the 11th Commandment. I'm your slightly eccentric host, and I want you to enjoy an amusing and educational experience today. My guest is Steve Wilson. He's America's joyologist, the chairman of the board, founder of the World Laughter Tour. Hello and welcome, Steve.
Hi, January. Happy to be with you.
I'm so happy to have you on my show. I've been looking forward to this interview ever since I met you at the AATH conference cruise to Mexico, and I'm thrilled that this is finally happening.
Me too.
Before I begin, I'd like to share with my listeners your fascinating background as an author. I would like to read some of the titles of your books. One of his books is called Eat Dessert First. I like that one. Super Humor Power, The Art of Mixing Work and Play, Remarried with Children, Toilet Paper, Toothpaste, and Tuna Noodle Casserole, Chill, and Good-Hearted Living. Those are all fabulous titles. I love them. Now, Steve, before we start, could you briefly tell us a little bit about where your journey began and how your story starts?
Journey began in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was born there.
Oh, okay.
In 1941.
Ah. And where do you live now?
Now I live in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. As you know, my husband's a Buckeye.
Yes, go Bucks.
No, I always ask for the weather report. What's the weather report from Columbus today?
The weather report today. It's 78 degrees and sunny, and the surf's up, and, wait, I'm sorry, I was looking at Hawaii.
Oh, darn.
It's 28 degrees and snow covered.
Okay.
Didn't that sound good?
Yeah, but now we're right back to reality.
We're at the tail end. We're at the tail end of winter.
Right. I'm from Michigan, and I remember the dark days of March, but spring is coming.
It is.
Okay, so now you started out in Pennsylvania, and how did your journey get you to Columbus?
Well, I went to school, my high school undergraduate and graduate education at Temple University in Philadelphia, and then came to Ohio to be enrolled in the doctoral program at Ohio State University.
Oh, so you are a Buckeye too, yes.
So I'm a Buckeye, I'm a transplant.
Okay, okay.
I've been around for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And really, all along the way, there were touch points in my career that said, this guy is headed towards something that has to do with fun and balance and laughter and humor.
Mm-hmm.
Because along the way, to getting to Columbus,
uh-huh.
I had a tap dance recital.
Okay.
I was 4 years old. I loved being on the stage. I found out that I had a knack for telling jokes.
Okay.
Only about 2% of people have this ability to remember and then tell jokes. Got me sent home from school in the first grade with a note from the teacher about these talking parrot jokes that were not appropriate. But, gee, the guy did my dad's pineapple flute.
Loved him.
Loved him. I was a yo-yo champion.
Oh, wow.
Folk singer. I'm an amateur magician. and an actor.
Yeah.
All these things really were revealing my overall basic purpose in life. When I got to be a psychologist and I was practicing a very conventional kind of psychology, I think having to do with anxiety and depression and marital problems and stress and
all the standards,
those kind of addictions and those
right.
things. But I came across material and information about the psychology of humor.
Oh, okay. So then that became your passion.
The light went on. The,
right,
the lightning flash fell in, and a voice said, "This is what you should be teaching people. Bring this to the world."
Oh, wonderful.
And humor and laughter became my life. Transformed my life, transformed my practice of psychology.
And I think it transforms everyone that meets you. I've been fortunate enough to meet Steve, and you know, the first thing you do when you see Steve and talk to him is you start smiling and laughing. It's just a contagious reaction that you create. How did you become a joyologist, and did you create that word?
I invented the word joyology.
Yes. I love it.
Yeah, well, the suffix at the end of a word, ology, when you have ology at the end of a word, it means the study of
something. Okay. Yes. Well, see, I call myself a winologist.
So you study wine.
Right. Absolutely.
Of course.
Yes.
So joyology would be the study of joy, contentment, happiness. What is that about? How do we get it? Why is it so darn important?
And your slogan is "Don't postpone joy."
Right. And that is a message that came out of tragedy in my life. Seeking to understand why. In my case, it was that my mother died of ovarian cancer when I was 20 years old. A very insidious, sneaky disease. She was a lively, going concern, 52 years old. Didn't feel well, and doctors weren't sure, and they tried a few things, and by the time she was diagnosed, it was a few weeks, and then she died.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and I was in graduate school. So
it changed your life.
Well, you know, you start asking why, and what's the point? And I come from a tradition that that somewhere in here there must be a lesson that if you can figure it out, it's going to really be good for you, even if it's a very awful circumstance. Let's look for a good lesson.
Right. You know, when I was on the cruise with you, so many of the wonderful people that I met at AATH, they were all there because all of them had experienced some kind of tragedy, the randomness of life. And it seemed like that was a tragedy or experience that brought them and taught them so much. Didn't you notice that?
Well, yeah, I think that if you are a great deal of humor is laughter made from pain. A sense of humor is really the ability to look at all sides of a situation, even something catastrophic, and find one even tiny side that isn't quite so serious.
Right.
And hang on to that because that's the saving grace.
That's what will get you through.
And yeah, and in my case, the one of the answers that came to me about
what?
My mom was
yeah.
the lesson is don't postpone joy.
Ah.
You know, you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, and we have to make the most out of every day.
It actually goes right back to the famous seize the moment and live
right.
the day.
Carpe diem, gather the rosebuds while you may.
Absolutely.
And we need to be reminded because when we hear it, we say, oh, yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get busy with something else, and we get caught up in something else, and we forget.
That is so true. Now, you talk a lot about humor and laughter, and you relate them to mental health and work. That's such an important connection. Could you elaborate a little bit more about that?
It seemed to me, in my practice of psychotherapy,
mm-hmm.
and in looking at various definitions of mental health,
right.
that a good sense of humor and an adequate amount of laughter in your life are signs of mental health. I think when the humor
mm-hmm.
goes away and the laughter is lost in our lives, our mental health is on the brink or is gone. When the mental health comes back,
mm-hmm.
and the laughter returns.
Yeah.
So I saw that if I could help my patients find their sense of humor and have permission to exercise that periodically, even when there's stress and tension and difficult, worrisome things going on, it provided a balance and it kept them sort of mentally better balanced.
Absolutely. You know, so many people hate going to work, and it's got to just be so depressing if you're working at something you don't enjoy. You recommend that fun be institutionalized at work. How would people go about doing that?
Well, what I mean by that is don't make just a little passing effort at trying to have a little bit of humor at work. There are lots of ways to lighten up the workplace and do it in a way that nobody has to be a clown or a buffoon.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the humor pulls us together as a team. The humor becomes part of a communication style that helps us with customer service and relating to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of a humor that we want. But,
We need to
have a committee for it. We need to have it in our goals and objectives for the organization.
Make it part of the agenda.
It's part of the institution.
Yes. So if you're going to be institutionalized, you might as well have fun.
That's who said that. Marriage is an institution. Who wants to live in an institution?
Well, now, can you tell me what, in your opinion, is the big difference between humor and laughter?
Well, yes, humor is a psychological phenomenon.
Okay.
It's a kind of a state of mind.
It happens in your brain.
It does. It's an interpretation of something that says to you personally, that's funny.
So you get it.
You get it. And in your value system, your tastes, your beliefs, your preferences, you think that's funny. And so when that happens, that's humor. You're experiencing humor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, when people experience humor, although it doesn't have to be, because they laugh.
Mm-hmm.
That act of laughing is a very physical act.
Right.
And it is associated with, we now know, a number of changes in brain chemistry and in the biology all throughout the body. Laughter is physical. Humor is a state of mind. And connecting them somehow is another phenomena we call mirth.
Mirth.
And
okay.
Mirth is an emotional condition.
All right, Steve, when we come back after our break, we're going to discover why laughter is the best medicine and why mirth is something that we should consider. This is January Jones on BigMediaUSA.com. This is January Jones back with my wonderful guest, Steve Wilson. Steve is the founder of the World Laughter Tour, And we were talking about why laughter is the best medicine. And Steve is going to share with us his thoughts about the word mirth.
Ah, yes, mirth.
It kind of rhymes with birth now.
It does.
Now, where are we going here?
Which is why, you know, May the 4th this year, the first Sunday in May,
okay,
is World Laughter Day.
Oh, I love that.
A day when we want everyone to set aside cares and troubles.
Uh-huh.
And
laugh.
And laugh. And be mirthful. And
that's special.
About the fact that when you're having good natured laughter together, nobody's interested in fighting.
We need more of that
that's
in the world.
Right. So that's the first Sunday in May, and so I thought, well, it's a day for mirth. It's a mirth day.
Okay, and
so
laughter.
The greeting is
happy
mirth
day. Yeah, okay. And if it happens to be your birthday, you're really in luck.
The world will explode.
Birthday.
That's fabulous. And that's also, let's see, May. That's May Day. Actually, the first day of May.
That's right.
So that's when a lot of things are happening. Tell me, in your opinion, can everything in life be fixed by laughing, joking about it, and being mirthful?
Oh, no. No, no, no.
No.
Laughter is a balancer.
Okay. And it's not a quick fix.
Humor is a balancer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a quick fix for light troubles.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
For the lighter things that are happening, that are annoyances, and if you can see the humor in it right there, you're
going
to get past it.
Now, is everyone born with a sense of humor, or is this something you have to develop?
Yeah, the good news is it's something you develop.
Oh, it's not in your DNA.
No. It's like if you're born with curly hair, you've got curly hair. Your sense of humor doesn't seem to be programmed in there.
It's not. Okay.
Something you can work on.
So you learned this from your mother and from your father.
Well, some people do. Some people don't have very funny mothers and fathers.
Okay. That would be a problem.
They learn it from radio and television. They learn it from their friends. They learn it because they have a favorite comedian. Maybe one that that makes humorous observations about life, like Irma Bombeck.
Right.
So good at that. So you look at something happens in your life, and you say, now, how would Irma Bombeck look at this? Now you're looking at life through humor eyes.
Well, now, I may not have been born with a sense of humor, but you know what? I was born, and I am a compulsive smiler. I just smile all the time.
But laughing and smiling are programmed in at birth.
Okay, those two things. Okay, because I got those big time.
Laughter is a universal ability. All human beings have it. They start to show it at around 4 to 6 weeks of age.
Oh, really? Okay. I think I showed it sooner.
You were a prodigy.
My mother thought so.
it carries with it a chemistry within the body.
Oh, interesting.
That goes with laughing and smiling. It's very helpful. And we keep that all our lives. The problem is, life gets more tense and stressful and worrisome, and the laughter gets less and less and less as we get older and older and older. So we have to help people to get back some laughter, reclaim your laughter.
Try to go back to the playfulness, the times of your childhood, the innocence, the carefree moments.
Lighten up. Now, that's very interesting that you said that, because human beings only show their ability to laugh and smile under certain conditions. Towards that infant, to be healthy.
Yeah.
Sick children do not laugh and smile.
Oh, my gosh.
That infant has to be fed and nourished and taken care of. Hungry, starving babies don't laugh and smile.
Right. Okay.
The environment has to be calm and quiet. Children who are being raised where the bombs are going off and the bullets are going overhead, they're not laughing and smiling. They're not playing very much.
Absolutely. Now,
certain conditions that are conducive to human growth and health that also mm-hmm. bring out the laughter.
Right. Now, when we come back, Steve, I have another question. I want to talk about why crying is just as important as laughing. This is January Jones, the wine tester, on BigMediaUSA.com. This is January Jones, and I want to welcome you back to Thou Shalt Not Wine, the 11th Commandment, with my guest, Sally Shields. Before we took our break, we were talking about the strategies to, surefire strategies to help you get along with your mother-in-law. Before we go back to that, Sally, could you share with my listeners a little bit about your website and how they can get your book?
I would absolutely love to. If you go to the daughter in the DIL rules, and DIL stands for daughter-in-law, DILrules.com, you can, if you sign up for my newsletter, you'll get a free copy of the 44 top tips cheat sheet.
Okay.
I absolutely love it. And if you get a copy of the book, you will get two free full-length CD albums. One is a lullaby album.
Oh, okay.
That I wrote and I'm playing on a solo piano called New Melodies.
Uh-huh. And are these melodies that you've created?
I wrote them for my daughter.
Oh, how wonderful.
And the second album is called Cruisin', and it was written when my son was born, and that was actually played on all.
Oh, really?
So it's a jazz trio record, and it's got really, like, it's also very melodic, but it's more bouncy. Like, you can kind of, like, dance.
Okay.
You can get those two albums for free.
And I want our listeners to know that one of the upcoming events for Sally is this next week is going to be her birthday. And would you like to share with my listeners about the wonderful promotion you're going to be doing at Amazon?
I would love to. I am actually, my goal is to get into the top 10 on Amazon.com for the bestseller list on my birthday, which is a Tuesday, May 6th.
Oh, what a wonderful birthday gift to give yourself.
But it's also so great for me because what I've done is I've actually created a great bonus gift bundle.
Uh-huh.
If anyone who buys my book on that day, they will get over 83 gifts from the top successful business and relationship experts from all around the world.
Uh-huh.
And you can actually go check it out right now at thedilrules.com/special offer.
Okay, but now we want to make sure that the my listeners know that they should actually wait to buy your book for that special day.
That, yes, it's clearly written on that website.
So wonderful.
On May 2nd, May 6th, you'll be eligible for all of those wonderful, wonderful gifts. And I'm so excited because, you know, I always love to give away gifts on my birthday, especially after having become 40. I like to turn the table over. I like to be the one to give presents.
And as everyone knows, it's more fun to give than to get. Now, let's go back to the strategies we were talking about. We left off with three strategies. The first one was call at a regular time, ask for advice, send cards and flowers. What was number four?
Okay. What you want to do is one of them, you know, you can take this one or leave this one. But I advocate calling your mother-in-law and mom. I find that it really makes you feel special.
Uh-huh.
Because when you first get married, she has stars in her eyes just like you do, and she's looking forward to having another daughter. And, you know, if you call your mom, she's going to love it. You know?
It'll make it much easier, won't it?
Yeah, much easier. And, you know, maybe they'll say, oh, you can just call me friend or whatever. But, you know, if you make that special effort, it might feel uncomfortable at first, but you'll get used to it. And
you know what I'll share with you, that our family's Norwegian, and since I'm now the grandmother in Norway, your mother's mother is called your mormor, and your mother's father is called your morfa. So I've become mormor, which is wonderful because I have my own special designation as mom to everyone and mormor to the grandchildren. And I love it because every time they say it, I'll say, do you want mormor cookies? And they always do that. They love that. Okay, that's really good advice. And what about number five?
Okay. You want to compliment your mother-in-law, and you want to proactively do this. For example, ask her if you need a certain item of clothing, or an accessory for your car or purse.
Mm-hmm.
For example, remember when we were in high school and we traded clothes with our girlfriends? It doesn't feel good when you see someone wearing something that you adore.
And then,
yeah,
and then she'll know that you like her taste, and that's another bond that you will have.
Exactly. And it's not something that you know, wearing a scarf or a purse isn't going to really, it's not going to change your whole fashion statement there. So you can really do a lot of wonders with that.
And what about number six?
Okay, you want to tell her what a great job she did as a mother. For example, let's say your husband does something wonderful around the house, like you clean the gutters, unclog the sink. Give her a call and tell her, "Mom, you did a great job raising your son. You're such a wonderful husband. This will bring her to tears, and you will love these moments. This is really great."
And so will she. So will she.
Exactly.
And what's your last suggestion?
And the last little suggestion is, you want to ask her how she's feeling, and you want to ask her for help, because as we go older, you know, things can get the best of us, and make even the best of us and the most healthy of us as ornery as all get go. I mean, I often, you know, when I'm sick, I think, gosh, you know, I really understand why old people are cranky, because it's not fun, you know, you got aches and pains. And a lot of times, as, you know, older people do have them, and that's why they take it ornery. So you want to make sure you ask her how you're feeling. Like, almost every time you talk to her, you pick up the phone, "How are you feeling today, Mom?" It makes you feel great, like you really care.
Oh, that's so sweet. Now, what would you consider the most common mistake that a daughter-in-law would make?
So I boiled it down to three things.
Three, okay. What's number one?
The first one is expecting your mother-in-law to share your interests. Okay, you don't want to expect her to join your book club. You don't want to expect her to share your interest in music. You don't want to expect her to share your interest in movies. You don't want to expect her to share your interest in TV shows, because it may or may not happen, and
so,
you might end up getting billed, which is your daughter-in-law zinged.
Yeah, so you can't expect her to be your new best friend.
No, you just cannot expect her to share your interests. And if you keep that in mind and understand that, you won't feel personally offended if she comes along and doesn't like the same stuff you like.
Okay, now what about the second mistake?
Number four, getting rid of gifts prematurely. This is a big mistake.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing more humiliating than not being able to produce whatever it may be upon inquiry.
Yes.
So in other words, if your mother-in-law gives you something that's not quite your cup of tea, it doesn't matter if you want to display it prominently in your home or wear it regularly when she's around. And make sure that you keep it for at least a minimum of 4 years. I mean, probably 2 or 3 years, but I say, you know, minimum of 4 years, at which point she'll be on to the next gift.
Yeah, you definitely don't want her to see it at the thrift shop.
No. You want to make a point of wearing it around, because that's when she'll appreciate it.
Okay. And now, what's the third?
The third biggie is getting defensive. You really want to keep that in check when you're around your mother. It's very easy to do. As a matter of fact, I did it for 10 years. You don't want to do it.
That's too long.
For example, okay, maybe not 10 years, but I'll just give you a quick example. Like, I'll be, you know, she'll be in the kitchen and she'll be visiting, and I'll be mumbling something to myself, like, "Oh my gosh, where are those new teapots that I just got?" And of course, my mother-in-law will try to say, "Don't look at me, I didn't do it." And she'll get defensive, and then of course, "I want to get defensive. I didn't say you took them, did I?" So then it gets into this little power struggle.
And you're off to the races, which is not a good idea.
Exactly. So what I say is you need to have something ready in your back pocket, like, "Oh my gosh, I am just so forgetful. You know, last week I found my keys in the fridge." And then what you want to do is find your tea bag and then offer her a nice cup of tea.
Okay. Very good. This is quite amazing. I wrote in my book, "Thou Shalt Not Whine," about, I have over 100 cures for whining, and now as I'm listening to you, I realize you have well over 100 strategies for dealing with mother-in-law. There's been quite a bit of research here.
Indeed.
Since I do write about wining, what would be a holiday time wine, or what would be the stress that would come up over the holidays, and how would you survive that?
One of the big stresses is, being enticed by sugary temptations. Let's say that, you've really committed to losing that last 10 pounds. You've dragged this torso track out from under the bed. You've dusted off the dust bunnies, and you've sworn off carbs. Of course, as soon as you step over the threshold into your mother-in-law's house, there's cake on every table. There's cookies. There's pudding. And of course, she'll... sweet and sour in every kind of pasta. Oh, dear, you must try some kolache. Oh, you have to try this cheesecake. And, of course, when in Rome. So it's very stressful because you can really get off your diet. So what I suggest is you just kind of combat that. Throw a set of five-pound weights in the car, throw a set of sneakers in the car, and do a little bit of resistance training while you're there, and take her dog for long walks around the park and maybe long walks to the mall to burn off a few extra calories. The main thing is, you don't want to beat yourself up. You can get right back on track as soon as you get home.
Yeah, and the reality is it's insane to even try to diet over the holidays.
Insane, yeah, absolutely.
I think if you can just hold your own and not think about losing weight, but just stay at the status quo, you'll have a great holiday.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, now what about your the super secret strategies that eliminates arguments with your husband?
Okay, now I call the
about his mother.
This is the secret CSI strategy for eliminating all your arguments with your husband. Number one, what you want to do is you want to eliminate all criticism of his mother. That's the biggest no-no. Please, ladies.
Is it the kind of thing where he can criticize her, but he doesn't want to hear you do it?
Yeah, you can't do it. I did it. It doesn't work.
Uh-huh.
You want to do what works.
Okay.
So what you want to do is you want to stop criticizing. You want to stop criticizing, and what you want to do is you want to set aside all your gripes for your trusty daughter-in-law solutions worksheet, which I can briefly explain, which is the Inc. Superdeals template, which is INCF. Identify the problem, note what was done or said, create a rule title, and set up a solution. So you can sort of save all your gripes and work it into this Inc. template, which we can explain a bit later. The third secret strategy is imitations. It's very easy for all of us to lapse into those imitations if we're very upset with our mother-in-law if something she said or upset us, and we sort of imitate her voice when we're explaining to our husband what she said that upset us. But it's very important to save all imitations for your Tuesday night comedy improv class.
Okay. Very good.
Not something you want to do in front of your husband. He can do it, but not you.
Yes, that is very, very good advice. Now, quickly, let me ask you, what about when you have a new baby, and this baby happens to be your mother-in-law's first grandchild? How do you deal with that? This is the grandchild she's been waiting forever for.
Okay, well, there's a secret strategy here. Okay, number one, you want to let her share in your pregnancy joy. You really want to make sure that, you don't keep this all, you're the one that's first pregnant. You think that, you're the queen that's bride all over again, but it's also her first grandchild.
Right.
You really have to let her in on the joy. Don't try to feel like you're your joy. Share it with her.
Now, what do you do when there's two grandmothers? How do you have that situation?
You mean my mother and my husband's mother?
Right. How do they get along?
Oh, well, they never see each other.
Oh, perfect.
One lives in Ohio, one lives in Massachusetts.
Oh, but what a great solution that is.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I can't speak on that.
Okay, well, when we come back, I'll ask you about some things that you can tell us about. And this is so much fun talking with Sally Shields on the 101 Rules on How to Get Along with Your Mother-in-Law. January Jones here on BigMediaUSA.com. This is January Jones welcoming you back to BigMediaUSA.com. I'm the author of Thou Shalt Not Wine, the 11th Commandment, to be published this year by Buford Books. I invite you to visit my website, www.januaryjones.com, where you can see all my videos on YouTube and some of the other things I've been up to. I'm visiting today with Steve Wilson, the founder of the World Laughter Tour. Steve is a guest with a voice that's filled with common sense, good advice, and great humor. Steve, you talked earlier about something about some new research. Could you share that with my listeners?
Yes, this is pretty exciting. The World Laughter Tour, our organization, is backed up by a group of professionals who are researchers, social scientists, practitioners of various kinds in laughter and humor. And one of them is a world-famous researcher in the field of humor and the immune system. Now getting into humor and its use and effectiveness with cardiac patients. So just sent a study to us, which was just published, called Humor as an Adjunct Therapy in Cardiac Rehabilitation.
Okay.
An adjunct therapy, it means it's not the primary treatment, but it helps the primary treatment work better.
Okay.
So this was with patients who had diabetes and who had had a heart attack.
Okay.
And they followed them for a year.
Now, how much laughter were they?
One group had a half an hour every day of self-selected humor.
Like the kind we did on the ship?
They could have watched a comedy show on television, or whatever they, whatever would appeal to their sense of humor. And the other group, and they had the standard, in addition to that, medication and other interventions for cardiac rehab.
Sure.
The other group had all the interventions for cardiac rehab, but were not encouraged to spend time in humor every day.
Okay.
They were the serious group. The regular group.
Normal.
The regular rehab group. The group that added the humor into their routine. Arrhythmias. They had fewer times when their heart didn't, work right. They had significantly less use of nitroglycerin for chest pain. And a significantly fewer recurrences of heart attacks.
Wow. So they had a conclusively better recovery.
And they definitely could measure the fact that humor reduced the stress hormones in the body, which are, associated with more heart attacks.
That is wonderful.
So here is this research. Our folks who are part of our website and who are certified laughter leaders, this is the kind of information that they have.
Yeah, and we need to get this out there.
We've got a wonderful, fun program, but it's really based on solid
research
and evidence. And this is ancient.
Yeah.
People have known the saying, laughter is the best medicine, from the book of Proverbs. Thousands of years ago, people knew.
Hello.
Lighten up.
We need to get it. Oh, my gosh, do we need to get it. Another thing my listeners need to get is your newest book called Good Hearted Living. And as you're listening to Steve tell us about research and humor, I know that you will love reading his book. This has been such a wonderful interview, Steve, and I've been really enjoyed visiting with you and finding out more about your program.
It's been fun. And Good Hearted Living, this is a simple six-step program to prevent hardening of the attitude.
Okay, I got it.
Wonderful. Easy, and people can do it. Get the book and get information on our website.
Wonderful. This is January Jones, your slightly eccentric host, hoping you have enjoyed our show, The 11th Commandment, today featuring Steve Wilson. Now I want all my listeners to try to remember, stop whining and start laughing. And if that doesn't work, you better start eating chocolate, lots and lots of chocolate. Remember, you heard it here, chocolate is the new broccoli. Thank you, Steve, so much. And I'll look forward.
Thank you, January. My pleasure.
And I'll look forward to visiting with all my listeners again next week on BigMediaUSA.com. For now, this is January Jones signing off with cheers, chocolates, and laughter.
Yes, that's her way of saying, don't leave me home.
No, she did it before we even got out of bed.
And he said that the department was missing in action.
Well, no, we have glitches where they move thousands of votes from my account to Biden's account, and these are glitches. So they're not glitches, they're theft. They're fraud, absolute fraud. This election was over, and then they did dumps. They call them dumps, big, massive dumps in Michigan and Pennsylvania and all over. How the FBI and Department of Justice, I don't know, maybe they're involved, but how people are allowed to get away from this stuff, with this stuff is unbelievable.
Now, spurred by what he saw, Barr told the Associated Press on December 1st that there was no evidence of election fraud. And immediately after, Attorney General Barr's statement went public. Mr. Trump berated and immediately fired Barr. But Barr persisted in telling the president that there was no evidence to support the fraud claims.
This was done under my skin, but I also felt it was time for me to say something. So I set up a lunch with the AP reporter, Mike Balsamo, and I told him at lunch, make the statement that to date we have not seen fraud on scale that could have affected a different outcome in the election. I had a later meeting scheduled at the White House at 3 o'clock with Meadows. This was previously scheduled, so I knew this was going to come up, and I went over there and I told my secretary that I thought I would probably be fired and go back to go home. I did not go back to my office, so I said, you might have to pack up two of me. And so when I got over there, I met with the chief of staff. He said the president was angry. He didn't really get into the issue of the fraud. And then I went up to Pat Cipollone's office and we were talking with each other. And word came down that he wanted us both to go to the Oval. And the president was as mad as I've ever seen, and they were trying to control themselves. The president said, well, this is killing me. You didn't have to say this. You must have said this because you hate Trump. You hate Trump. And then he raised the big vote dump, as he called it, in Detroit. And that, he said people saw boxes coming into the counting station at all hours of the morning. So forth, and I explained to him that I wanted the exact number of precincts in Detroit. I think it was 630 something. I said, "Mr. President, there are 630 precincts in Detroit and elsewhere in the state. They centralize the counting process, so they're not counted in each precinct. The counting stations, and so the normal process would involve boxes coming in at all different hours. So there's nothing." And I said, did anyone point out to you that all the people complaining about it on that you actually did better in Detroit than you did last time? I mean, there's no indication of fraud in Detroit. And I told him that the stuff that his people were shoveling out to the public were bullshit. I mean, that the claims of fraud were bullshit. And, he's a statement about that. And, reiterated that they wasted a whole month on these claims on the Dominion voting machines, and they were idiotic claims. And I specifically raised the Dominion voting machines, which I found to be one of the most disturbing allegations, disturbing in the sense that I saw absolute zero basis for the allegations, but they were made in such a sensational way that they obviously were influencing a lot of people, members of the public, that there was this systemic corruption in the system and that their votes didn't count and that these machines controlled by somebody else were actually determining it, which was complete nonsense. And it was being laid out there, and I told them that it was crazy stuff. I wasted the time on that. And I was doing great, great disservice for the country.
Okay, so the very next day, President released a video rehashing some of the very same claims that his chief law enforcement officer had told him were, quote, nonsense.
Here's an example. This is Michigan. At 6:31 in the morning, a vote dump of 149,772 votes came in unexpectedly. We were winning by a lot. That batch was received in horror. We have a company that's very suspect. Its name is Dominion. With the turn of a dial or the change of a chip, you can press a button for Trump and the vote goes to Biden. What kind of a system is this? Barr again told the president that there was nothing to these claims on December 14th.
And I walked in and sat down, and he went off on a dialogue saying that there was now definitive evidence
is either fraud through the Dominion machines, and a report had been prepared by a very reputable cybersecurity firm, which identified as Allied Security Operations Group, and he held up the report, and he asked that a copy of it be made for me. And while a copy was being made, he said, you know, this is absolute proof that the Dominion machines were rigged. The report means that I'm going to have a second term. And then he gave me a copy of the report. And as we talked more and more about it, I sat there flipping through the report and looking through it. And to be frank, it looked very amateurish to me. Didn't have the credentials of the people involved. I didn't see any real qualifications. And the statements were made very conclusively, like, you know, these machines were designed to, you know, engage in fraud or something to that effect, but I didn't see any supporting information for it. And I was somewhat demoralized because I thought, boy, if he really believes this stuff, he has, you know, lost contact with he's become detached from reality. If he really believes this stuff. On the other hand, you know, when I went into this and would tell him how crazy some of these allegations were, there was never an indication of interest in the actual facts. My opinion then and my opinion now is that the election was not stolen by fraud. And I haven't seen anything since the election that changes my mind on that, including the 2000 Mules movie.
Well, maybe you can assess that 2000. Some people were talking about that
2000.
Well, I mean, just in a nutshell, you know, I'm impressed with it, and I was totally unimpressed with it because I think I was holding my fire on that to see what the photographic evidence was, because I looked at the little arrows they have. A lot of photographs of the same person dumping a lot of ballots in different boxes, you know, that's hard to explain. So I wanted to see what the photographic evidence was, but the cell phone data is singularly impressive. I mean, basically, if you take 2 million cell phones and figure out where they are physically in a big city like Atlanta or wherever, just by definition, you're going to find many hundreds of them have passed by and spent time in the vicinity of these boxes. And the premise that, you know, if you go by the box, you know, 5 boxes or whatever it was, you know, that's a mule is just indefensible. By definition, you're going to have hundreds of this. I mean, one contractor said, we figured out that our truck alone would account for 6 cell phone signals. This is a contractor, and, you know, our room would take us by these things on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So, but then when the movie came out, you know, I think the photographic evidence in it was completely lacking. I mean, there was a little bit of it, but then it was lacking. It didn't establish widespread illegal. Harvesting. The other thing is people don't understand is that it's not clear that even if you can show harvesting, that changes the results of the election. The courts are not going to throw out votes and then figure out what votes were harvested and throw out. It's still a burden on the challenging party to show that illegal votes were cast. Votes were the result of undue influence or bribes or they were cheating. The person was non-compos mentis, but absent that evidence, I just didn't see courts throwing out votes anyway. I felt that before the election, it was possible to talk sense to the president. And while you sometimes had to engage in big wrestling match with him, there was possible to keep things on track, but I was felt that after the election, he didn't seem to be listening. I didn't think it was, I was inclined not to stay around if he wasn't listening to advice from me or his other cabinet secretaries.
So on December 14th, Barr quit. Now, the Attorney General wasn't the only person who told the President that his claims were false. Other officials and close advisors told him the same thing.
perspective is to try to put it in very clear terms to the President. And I said, don't
externally done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews. The major allegations are not supported by the evidence developed. We've worked with Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada. We're doing our job. Much of the info we get is false. And then I went into, for instance, this thing from Michigan, this report about 68% error rate. Reality is there's only 0.0063% error rate, less than 1 in 15,000. So the president accepted that. He said, okay, fine, but what about the others? And again, this gets back to the point that there were so many of these allegations that when you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, so then I talked about a little bit about Pennsylvania truck driver. This is another allegation that had come up. And this claim was by a truck driver who believed, perhaps honestly, that he had transported an entire tractor-trailer truck full of cows from New York to Pennsylvania. And this was, again, out there in the public and discussed. And I essentially said, look, we looked at that allegation. We looked at both ends, both the people who loaded the truck and the people who unloaded the truck. And that allegation was not supported by the evidence. But then he said, okay. And he said, no, I didn't mention that one. What about the others? And I said, okay, well, we're going to Georgia to look at the individual witnesses. There is no suitcase. The president kept fixating on the suitcase that supposedly had part of the cows, the suitcase that pulled out on the table. And I said, no, so there is no suitcase. You can watch that video over and over. There is no suitcase. There is a wheel bin where they carry the ballots, and that's just how they move ballots around that facility. There's nothing suspicious about that at all. I told them there was no medical scanning of the ballots. Well, there's one part of that allegation that they've taken one ballot and screened it through three or four or five times to rack up votes presumably for Vice President Biden. I told them that the measure did not support that. Then he went off on double voting. That's off the next page. He said that people are voting. Indians are getting the things that vote and that people on Native American reservations. He said there's lots of fraud going on here. Open flat out that much of the information he's getting is false and or is not supported by the evidence. We look at the allegations, they don't pan out.
Mr. Barr and his advisors were not the only ones who determined that the president's allegations regarding Dominion voting machines were false. So, Mr. Chairman, respect to the evidence consent to include in the record of this hearing reports issued by the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, otherwise known as CISA, that addressed and rejected the claims of manipulation of voting machines in the 2020 election.
Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also ask unanimous consent to include in the record a report prepared by the Michigan Senate Oversight Committee that disproved claims of election fraud in Michigan, as well as a statement by 59 of the country's leading election security scientists, noting the absence of any credible evidence that the 2020 election had been altered through technical compromise, and 5 other reports from organizations and individuals confirming there was no widespread fraud in the 2020 election, or describing the spread of the former
President's lives.
Without objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I yield back.
So it's to the order of the committee for the day. The chair declares the committee in recess for a period of approximately 10 minutes.
There's a recess now as the committee takes a quick break. We heard some tested testimony from a number of Trump insiders. Star witness, former Attorney General Bill Barr, who at one point said he was beginning to believe that Donald Trump, after the election, detached from reality. We also heard from other Justice Department officials and other individuals on the Trump campaign, all of them.
Detached from reality, it doesn't
get quite kind of creating unhinged conspiracy theory after unhinged conspiracy theory. Yeah,
absolute vivid description, painting a picture of just what he described, of a president of the United States, one after another, rejecting the sound advice, data-based advice that he was getting from the campaign manager, from the Attorney General of the United States, from the legal team that he ended up firing. All of that advice he rejected, and he instead chose the way that they described it, a drunk Rudy Giuliani and the people in his orbit, and wanted to listen to people who were telling him what he wanted to hear, but they didn't yet talk about
drunk Giuliani,
whether or not the president knew, whether he had intent. That knew what he was saying was wrong. And at some point, it's a question of, does that matter? When everybody around you is telling you that it's not true, does it really matter? Perhaps that's a question for the lawyers. But there's another element to several of the testimony. Bill Barr and other people around him, Bill Stephens, it got much more difficult to convince the president of anything rational. They were raising the question that we heard from Adam Kinzinger, one of the Republican voters today, over the weekend, who basically said, if Congress does believe all of these lies and conspiracy theories, now we also have questions about his capacity, his mental capacity in that role. And I think that that's actually the elephant in the room of a lot of his testimony. Bill Barr basically saying, you can't rationalize with this guy.
There's something else going on here, though, and this was a huge win for the committee. And Donald Trump's head is exploding right now because all of those people are in a circle, from his children to his lawyers to his campaign director. Bill Barr was the star witness. I agree with you. Each and every one said there was no fraud, and here are some of the terms. Idiotic, quote, bullshit, nuts, crazy, nonsense, laughable. We heard about Team Normal. Whatever Donald Trump's intent was, today was bad for him.
Incredibly important as you look back at what happened, to Jamie's point. Young attorneys, old guard people like Bill Barr, the campaign team, the political team, the legal team, everybody was citing the same thing as Team Normal, so he goes out to get Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. That's looking back at this historical record, critical, but we also have to pose this question. He still is the most dominant force in the Republican Party. Donald Trump continues to be the most dominant force in the Republican Party. Imagine wants to be Speaker. He continues to raise money out of it. The vast majority of Republicans will not say we need a clean break from this. What you're hearing today is corrupt. I'll leave the lawyers I were putting next to me. Is it illegal? I don't know. It's corrupt. And it's repeatedly corrupt after being told to serve the law to do the right thing.
Look, Donald Trump could not find a yes man among the cabinet. He created an army of yes men by psycho scheme time and time again over the course of more than 3 months to try to secure those yes men in a crowd heading to the Capitol. Every time you heard about the irony of him claiming fraud or searching for fraud against all rational fraud, he's essentially committing overt acts in furtherance of fraud, defrauding the United States by deceptive action. There is every inference that he was aware that he was no longer the president of the United States, that there had been states that had certified it, that they had legislatively lost all remedies, and he still fought to have that definite. He really, in this way, they have laid out the basic tenets of establishing, defrauding the government of the United States and stop an electoral college certification by the state and corrupt means. It's astounding that it's taken us this long to get right here, and they're not even that.
The hearing continues. I got a testimony from former Republican officials in Georgia and Pennsylvania. They were targets of Trump's ire after they rejected his false claims for election fraud. Stay right there. We'll carry it all on.
Your ability to find infections, including GE, bacteria infections and blood loss, some fatal cancers, including lymphoma and skin cancer, death, heart attack, stroke, and tears in the clinical intestine occurs. People 50 and older with at least one heart disease risk factor have higher risk. So taking allergic to rainbow, a serious reaction can occur. Tell your doctor if you are only become pregnant.
Talk to your immunologist about rainbow relief. Rainbow, make it your mission. Learn how happy you can help kids save on rainbow.
One person can cause an effect. One person in HR can challenge outdated patterns. Champion modern goods and vision for pay equity and to a job and to careers. HR empowers others to not only dream of change, but to create. The actions of a few affect the lives of many. Join SHRM today to cause the effect you wish to see in the workplace.
Right.
on the team wall, the people who were trying to tell the president, the former president, that there was nothing behind, nothing to support his thing about fraud. And you can hear from Barr the fact that suddenly, you know, look, he thought. He waited a few days, tried to see whether or not there any of these claims could stand up, and he decided that there wasn't. And so what you're going to hear from the next witnesses, including PJ Packer and from the other officials on Wednesday, is more of the same, is that they looked, they tried, they did hundreds of witnesses interviews, and they looked at dozens of investigations and did find nothing.
All right, thanks so much, Evan. And let's talk about what we've been hearing, because one of the things we've heard in the past is the degree to which Trump just started sounding like a crazy Facebook post in the final period, like Brady is doing. But what about the dozen and overnight in Detroit? What about the Temple being the tractor trail factor? What about ice cream vendor. I mean, just nonsense after nonsense. And you heard the last episode. They all had answers for all of them.
Yes. So Mark called the cyber call, and that's exactly the only thing about listening. What we're about to see is an extension of the Bill Barr system, which is BJ Pack for the Justice Department, specifically in Georgia. And what Barr described was a president who believed that the federal government, the DOJ, was supposed to do this work for him politically. And that clearly could be something that we're going to hear talk about explain in first person again.
And we have not heard from former U.S. Attorney B.J. Pack. The others did heard it at the tape on interviews, but this will be the first time that we got former Trump U.S. Attorney from Georgia in Georgia testifying publicly and sharing the story.
Yeah, and that will be so fascinating because that question resigned basically was under mysterious circumstances, and it seemed clear connected to all of this. But it was in the context of Trump personally, or personally making phone calls to Georgia officials to ask them to basically buy the vote. I'm curious about what the committee has on that front, because when you ask to buy a vote, it seems to imply that you know that there are no legitimate means to uncover fraud that would show that you want. It seems to imply that Trump knew that he needed to just come up with a number that would show him the name of the person to buy.
I think it was well being as the chairman, Ben Thompson, and the president of Mississippi, the vice chair of the state of Wyoming, where you have three elected officials, all three of them Republican, all three of them underlining the fact that Trump's claims for fraud were not true. And these are three crown Republicans, you should point out, former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt, B.J. Pack, of course, U.S. Attorney, was a Georgia state representative. Of course, Ben Ginsburg, who has been on the Supreme Court Republican. I believe that's not just going to get all that for them.
Committee will be in order. I now welcome our second panel of witnesses. The join today, B.J. Pack, Al Schmidt, Ben Ginsburg. Mr. Pack is a former United States Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia. Smith is a former city commissioner for the city of Philadelphia, and he served for more than 10 years. Mr. Ginsburg is one of the leading election law attorneys in the country and has represented Republican presidential candidates in election litigation dating back to 2000, where he represented George W. Bush in the Bush v. Gore litigation. I will now swear in our witness. Please stand and raise your right hand. If you swear or affirm on the oath of office that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, the glory of God.
These are all the big gun Republican lawyers that represented George Bush. Appointed by President Trump
served the U.S. Army in the Northern District of Georgia.
He served people appointed by Trump
in January 2021. He was the lead federal prosecutor there and worked for the Department of Justice under then Attorney General Bill Barr. Were you ever asked by Attorney General Barr to investigate claims of voter fraud in the 2020 election? And if so, what were those claims?
Congressman Baldwin, because of the question, approximately December 4th, I believe, of 2020, Attorney General Barr in a conversation about a debate piece. He said at the end of the conversation, Mr. Barr had asked me if I had seen a certain video scene of getting reported for years, where Mr. Giuliani, in a Fed opportunity sharing hotel the day before May 3rd, showed a videotape of a purportedly security tape at the Macarena in Atlanta, which is also in Fulton County, the city of Atlanta. Yes. At the time, Mr. Barr asked me that he had made a public statement that he had not seen any widespread election fraud that would question the outcome of the election. And because of the videotape, the serious allegation that Mr. Giuliani is making with respect to the suitcase full of ballots, or the video, he asked me to find out what I could about it. He had admitted that some days after a call that went to the White House for meeting and that issue might come up, he asked me to make it a priority to get to the bottom of try to substantiate the allegations made by
Thank you. I understand the Georgia Secretary of State's office investigated those state fraud allegations and couldn't find any evidence of fraud. What did you find when your office conducted its own investigation?
We found that two cases were full of ballots, the alleged black suitcase that was being pulled under the table was actually an official lockbox where ballots were kept safe. Found out that there was a mistake in terms of this understanding that there was a counting ballot, a counting ballot in the mind. And the partisan lockers
signed
for announcing at home. Wanted to realize the state so
he wasn't
I told the president myself that several times.
several conversations yet. These allegations about Fauci smuggled in a suitcase and run through the machine so high. It was not true that we looked at it. We looked at the video. We looked at it. It was not true.
Mr.
Perry,
asking about the Secretary's office on January 4th, what did you
every case deliver to us. No matter how fantastic, no matter how absurd, to everyone of us seriously, including this.
As it turns out, it is a close campaign mode that the dead baby plays.
I guess the folks in Philadelphia are disappointed in this. They only submitted 8,021 ballots from 50, mail-in ballots from 50. Probably easier for dead people to submit mail-in ballots than it is to vote in person.
Rooney was, at this stage of his life, the same ability to manage things at this level, or not? And obviously, the policy said, and that the allegations that they've made.
Mr. Schmidt, on November 11th, 2020, President Trump tweeted about you, saying he is, quote, a guy named Al Schmidt, Philadelphia commissioner and so-called Republican for Ohio, the big news victim by the fake news media to explain how honest things were with respect to the election in Philadelphia. He refuses to look at a mountain of corruption and dishonesty to be with. As a result of that, and the CNN interview you gave where you stated the dead voter claims in Pennsylvania were false, you and your staff were subjected to disturbing threats. Can you tell us about that?
The threats prior to that, and I'm sorry, I'll let those on the series talk about tweets, but we can really see the impact they have. Because prior to that, the threats were pretty general in nature. Corrupt election officials in Philadelphia are going to get what's coming to them. Or what the Second Amendment is for. Walking into the lion's den, all sorts of things like that. After the president tweeted at me by name, calling me out the way that he did, the threats became much more specific, much more graphic, and included not just me by name, included members of my family, my name, their ages, our address, our home, every bit of detail that you can imagine. That was the change.
Behind me are redacted threats to previous food that you provide to the committee. I mean, redacted portions of this act to protect their family. This is that I think I speak for all of my I say we had a deep story of what you and your loved ones have been through. I also want to thank you for your service to your country, for standing up for the rule of law. I want to thank both of you, Pat and Mr. Schmidt, for your service, your testimony, and for standing up for the rule. Now, I'd like to turn to another subject. Provide a legitimate venue for campaigns to challenge what they view as a regular election practice. Courts have a fine set of how the law applies to those challenges. We have a renowned legal expert here to address the top campaign venues. Mr. Ginsburg, you spent your entire career representing the Republicans and election.
Well, the Fargo Bank. I've got to go to the bathroom real quick.
Huh?
I have to go to the bathroom real quick.
Okay.
Your appointment's not for 1?
1.
And it's, what time now?
12:30.
All right, let me see.
I'm going to take her while we're with us on the call.
Make them see the beat in the car.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
You got the address for Mari, right?